Thank you all for coming to this, the first of our extensive series of CREASE-related programming for this semester. As many of you will already have seen, but I will highlight for those who have not, we are attempting this semester to emphasize the rebirth of the CREASE Brown Bag series, with an emphasis on our programming happening, I think, every week in the first half of the semester, at least, up through the break. So please try to put this in your calendar. We'll have a variety of events, different geographic foci, different disciplinary approaches, and we hope as many of you as possible will make this a core part of your calendar as we proceed. I'm sorry? And there are flyers by the door, so please pick those up if you haven't already received one, and please consider this an open invitation to join us. We have a couple of events already on the books coming up. This week we have the Haydostyan lecture through Armenian Studies and CREASE. That will be in the Hussey Room at the Michigan League by Gerard Chaliand. And many of you will have seen announcements about that as well. And the next CREASE-specific event will be one that many of you will also have noted. That is next week, again at this time in this place, this sort of a format. We will be joined by Alexei Yurchak, whom will be familiar, I'm sure, to many people in this room and from the Anthropology Department at Berkeley. So please put that on your calendar if it isn't already there. And without further ado, on to the main attraction, the kickoff event for this year. No pressure. This is such a pleasure to welcome back an alum. This is meant to be inspirational for the students in the audience. This is the sort of thing that you can do. Now there's really a lot of pressure coming. Our speaker is Stephanie DeGroot, who is a journalist, a practicing journalist. She is a graduate of the Reese program here. I won't specify dates, but it has been a little while since we've seen her in Ann Arbor. After graduating from U of M, she went off and was educated further at Columbia University, worked for more than a decade, maybe almost 15 years at ABC News, and is now at Sky News. She has a distinguished track record in journalism. And I told her I would brag on this. We have 3 Emmy Awards, not one, but 3 to her credit. We have a Peabody Award as well, and it's just simply a dazzling career. She will be speaking to us about her experience in Russia and her experience covering Russia in a time of turmoil and change, and the title for the talk today, Fear and Loathing in Moscow, Covering 11 Time Zones and 15 Republics During Times of Great Change, from 1989 to 1995.
Thank you all for coming. It's great to see a lot of familiar faces out there, because that'll make me feel better. When I was asked to give this talk, I thought, what on earth am I going to talk about? It's been, you know, ages, 15 years since I've lived in Russia, worked there, and I was, you know, trying to rack my brain for memories. And I realized that, you know, if I ever had to write a book about this time, I would call it the vodka years, because I realized that I drank so much vodka while I was there that it erased half my memory. So I've had to do a lot of research going back and trying to remember all the events and things. But you know, it's getting there. So if dates fall out of sequence, you guys have to keep me honest. So, I'm going to start with when I studied here in the 80s, early 80s, Brezhnev was in power. And, you know, it wasn't a very exciting time in Russia. It was, the biggest news stories were about arms control and whatnot. And then this guy came to power just as I was graduating. And I managed to get on a program, Pushkin program, to Moscow. And that was really, really hard to do back then. And so, you know, there was a lot of changes going on. You guys might remember this. I love socialist realism, so I'm just pulling a few of these out. If anybody remembers that Uskorenia was really a part of Gorbachev's plan. Chernobyl happened. Soviets weren't doing very well in Afghanistan. So things weren't going very well. The economy was in the tank. And then I rock up in Moscow in 1989. And Yeah, you can see, this actually isn't a very good picture, but just to give you, for those of you who don't know Russia, the Soviet Union, it's huge. 11 time zones, it takes up a sixth of the world's land mass, 120 languages spoken. I mean, you know, how do you cover something this size? It's incredibly daunting. So when I first got there, the miners' strikes were happening. And this was unprecedented, that the workers were actually stopping work, protesting. They wanted better pay, they wanted food, they wanted the basics. And that was a sign that things were not going well. And the fact that we were actually allowed to go and cover this and report on it was a first. And also things were starting to boil in terms of independence movements. And the second story I did was the hands across the Baltics, which was, I can't remember how many thousands of miles, how many hundreds of thousands of people, from Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, all holding hands along here. And we drove in a van for 3 days, didn't sleep, slept in the van when we could, to sort of capture this feeling of solidarity and protest and, you know, the growing independence movement. And it was fantastic. It was really exhilarating. So pretty much 90 early part, or 89 early part of 90 was covering the independence movements in the republics. So it was mostly Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, Georgia. I spent a lot of time in these places covering the independence movement. And during this time, the wall came down, Berlin Wall came down. So you could see where things were headed. And people were taking the opportunity. They were emboldened. It was a fantastic time to be in these places. There's Georgia. I'm sorry, I had to steal all these photos off the internet. I came from London, and all my pictures of my time in Moscow are back in London, so I'm sorry I have to do with second best here. And then Yeltsin, in 1990, resigned from the Communist Party. And so not only was, you know, the people were getting fed up with their economic situation, the republics wanted to be independent, but, you know, even the top brass was getting fed up. And change was really, really beginning to roll. And it was at that time that I started working for ABC News. I'd been working freelance up until this point, and ABC hired me because people just couldn't get enough of coverage of what was going on in the Soviet Union. And when I first got to ABC, their office was probably about the size of this room, with about 50 people working in it, and television equipment, editing equipment, and it was like a constant cocktail party. You know, as soon as somebody stood up from a chair, somebody else would sit down. You could not move. And the best thing to do was be out and about to sort of stay away from the hassles of being in the office. And we had some real characters. The correspondents I was working with, Jim Laurie and Rick Inderfirth, were very good correspondents. Rick was one of the guys who worked with Carter doing arms control. And he knew his stuff, and Jim Laurie was a really great, great correspondent. But there were people just coming and going all the time. There were always about three or four other correspondents, radio people, coming in. And then we had our KGB translator, our KGB-appointed translator, Irina, who was the sort of bedrock of the place. And we both loved and hated her because she would keep us from doing the things we shouldn't be doing, and would try to push the things that we didn't really care about. But she was, you know, to give her credit, she knew the people to talk to. She knew how to make things happen. And my first job at ABC was to go to a Kremlin press conference. And I had my accreditation, and I'm with my crew, and we're getting ready to go in the door. And I had just moved in Moscow from a foreigner's compound to a not-so-nice area of Moscow, but it was off the foreigner's compound. And my boyfriend at the time was worried about me. So he had given me a can of mace that I put on my keychain, just in case I get attacked. So I'm going to the Kremlin, go through the gates, get to the metal detector, put my keys out on the tray, and all of a sudden I get pulled aside. And I'm taken into security at the Kremlin and sat down for 2.5 hours and asked why I would be carrying a can of mace in a country where there is no crime and where it's the safest place for women to walk at night. You know, why would I do this? Did I want to gas the people inside the Kremlin? And there was a phone call made back to the office, and Irina had taken the phone call. And then all of a sudden I noticed that I was persona non grata from the Kremlin for the next 6 weeks. And later transpires that Irina loved to go to the Kremlin. She could sort of, you know, rub elbows with the hot shots, and that's how she made connections. And I think part of it, I mean, I suspect, that being PNG'd from going into the Kremlin was partly Irina's idea, so that she could keep going to the press conferences. But it's funny, for the next 2 years, whenever I would go in, I'd show my pass, and all the guys at the gates knew me, because there was a big, huge picture of me inside the Kremlin security office. So I was very popular with them. They loved me. So it's, where are we? What year are we? Independence movements are going. The Gulf War had started. Interest had kind of died down a bit. But in Lithuania, when was this? January 91. 14 people were killed at the Vilnius TV tower. The Soviets were trying to damp down the independence movement. And although I wasn't here for this, I was sent in. And I spent the next 8 weeks sort of holed up in and around the Lithuania parliament. Electricity had been cut off, heating had been cut off, water had been cut off. So, you know, I basically lived in this place for the next 2 months. And it was pretty dire living conditions. But the whole atmosphere around the place was of such defiance that you couldn't help but be caught up in it. It was hard going. It was a long winter. I remember I really wanted to get to someplace sunny after I was done with this. And then August 91, I'll talk about the coup in a minute, but I had been sent off to Vladivostok to cover some Pacific Fleet maneuvers. It was the first time they were going to let any Western news organization cover it. So I went with a Polish crew, thank God, because they had lots of vodka with them. We went to Vladivostok. We flew for something like 16 hours, and I had never been to Vladivostok, and I was really looking forward to it. And we landed, and you had the impression that you were just flying around in the air for 16 hours and landing in a suburb of Moscow. I mean, that's how it looked. And it was a really horrible place. Whoops, sorry, once again. And the reason I'm telling you this is that I finally got back to Moscow on the 18th of August, 1991, and I was completely, utterly jet-lagged. And I get a call the next morning saying, there's been a coup, there's tanks on the street, come now. And for the next 94 hours, I did not sleep. It was an incredible event. These guys were behind it. The first thing I had to do was go to the White House, where Yeltsin was holding a press conference. And luckily, our offices were quite near the White House. They were on Kutuzovsky Prospect. So it was within walking distance, about a 5-minute walking distance from there. Was there to witness this. And we just spent the entire day just out there filming. I would go talk to people, film, take the tape back to the office, come back, bring water, bring bread, bring whatever we could out to the crews. Try to figure out what the hell was going on, because it was really hard to judge what they were doing and what the coup leaders were doing and how this whole thing was going to pan out. Barricades were put up around the White House. And this is when I knew, well, I don't know if this is the point when I knew, but the tanks out on the streets, everyday people were going up to the guys in the tanks and chastising them, saying, why are you doing this? Why are you in tanks around the White House? How can you do this to us? Or handing them flowers. And the soldiers in the tanks, they didn't want to be there either. And then the barricades started getting built around the White House. And you knew that this was going to go one way. This is not a very good picture of people just sort of crawling out amongst the tanks. Women were handing their babies to these guys. It was a great atmosphere. And then thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of people gathered around the White House. And eventually, the tanks retreated. I think there was a little bit of bloodshed, not that much. And then Gorbachev was released. He had been in his dacha, holed up in his dacha in the south, couldn't communicate. So this is like almost 4 days nonstop covering what's going on. And I had zero sleep all this time. There he is. So after the coup's over, after everybody realizes that, they kicked the coup leaders out, it was a victory for democracy, I then got 4 hours sleep and then had to follow this flag around Moscow for, must have been about 20 miles, it felt like, and carrying my cameraman's equipment. But it was fun because people were just so excited about what had happened that they felt like they'd finally joined the rest of the world. And then we got to Dzerzhinsky Square. And for those of you who don't know, he was the starting guy for the KGB. He represented the KGB and everything awful about it. So this crowd had ended up there. And there's Lubyanka. And at first, the crowd kind of stops, and then people kind of timidly throw things, and then they run up to the building and kick the building and run back, afraid that something horrible is going to happen to them. And nothing horrible happens to them. You can see curtains kind of opening and then closing. And then they decide that they want to tear down Dzerzhinsky's statue. And it's a great moment. Rope goes around the neck. They tie it to a truck. And, everybody's cheering, and the truck goes. And it moves about an inch. It's not going to budge at all. So, and all this time, people are talking about, there's foreign currency stuck in there. He's made of gold. All these rumors flying around. So we ended up waiting there for about, 5-6 hours until somebody could find a crane. And come to find out, the crane came from the American Embassy. And so instead of this dramatic move of seeing Dzerzhinsky topple, you've got this long, drawn-out process of, you know, him being trussed up, and of course it had to be done right because the Americans were now in charge. You couldn't just drop it any old way. So, you know, being lifted and then slowly lowered onto the truck to take it away. So, dramatic moments. Yeltsin giving Gorbachev a really hard time. And then this moment, this was Christmas 1991, when the Soviet flag came down over the Kremlin for the last time, and then the Russian flag was raised. And it was a really emotional moment because, you know, on the one hand, you're so happy to see this go. On the other hand, here's an entire era. Here's, you know, 70 years just gone. And to not see, you know, I had always known the red flags flying everywhere, and it just seemed, it was a different country, completely, completely different country. So then, in between Christmas and New Year's, a little civil war broke out in Georgia. So I was sent to cover that, and I had never done a war before, and I had no idea what I was doing. And it was pretty scary. We came in, and nobody was prepared. Nobody had flak jackets. Nobody had hostile environment training, which you're now required to have. You know, we just got in a car and drove around. And I remember turning a corner at one point and tanks coming towards us and thinking, well, this is the wrong way to go. Let's back up and get out of here. And we ended up at the parliament. And I remember saying to the group I was with, it's like, didn't we talk about this? We had spent a whole night, the night before, in the hotel room saying, okay, we're not going to put ourselves in harm's way. This is not worth it. If we get in a situation where we're uncomfortable, we all leave. And so I'm sitting in the parliament, and it's getting pounded, and there's gunfire going everywhere. I was like, didn't we talk about this? I could have sworn we talked about this. I'm really not comfortable with this. But we got good stories out of it. And it ended, thankfully, not much later. I remember spending New Year's Eve thinking this could be my last New Year's Eve ever. But it wasn't. I lived to see many more. And then I was sent off to, shortly after this, to Nagorno-Karabakh, because I'd done so well in Georgia. They thought, well, why not send her to another war zone? So I went down there, and, you know, it was another one of these where you just had no clue. And I remember being with one army guy. He was a tank commander. And we were following him to try to film across the way to get shots of guys firing at us. Not a good idea. But they all of a sudden opened up on us. And I thought, well, if I stick close to this guy, I'll be okay. And you could hear the bullets whizzing overhead, and he just went, uh-oh, and started to walk away. I was like, oh my God, are we ever gonna get out of here? And so we had to climb into the tank and hightail it down the hill. But you know, I sort of felt like, this isn't really what I signed on for. You know, I'm Russian studies major. You know, I'm not a war correspondent. So it just kind of kept going in that vein. You know, Yeltsin was in power. The economy was still not great. And it was kind of turning into the Wild West days. But this is the second assault on the White House. And in covering this, it was really difficult to cover this because there was no way to get live transmission out of there because they cut off electricity. But luckily, all the news bureaus' offices overlooked the White House, so you could get these very dramatic pictures. But we had a couple of crews holed up in there. And the only way to get tapes in and out was to smuggle them in as food. And you know why the guards didn't sort of catch on that we were giving them cell phones and videotape and stuff. I don't know. Maybe they wanted us to. But, you know, here's another crisis that Russia has to deal with. And I remember this guy. He was quite crazy. He just kept wandering around with a white flag. This is Rory Peck. He was a friend of mine. During this time, I got sent to a lot of shitholes in the former Soviet Union. And if Rory was there at the airport, I knew I wasn't going to have a good time. I loved him, but as soon as I saw him, my heart would sink. And I would just think, oh, God, here we're going on another really, really bad trip. Rory worked for Frontline, which was a group of freelance cameramen who basically went into war zones or went to places other people didn't want to go to. You know, he was a great guy. He was fearless. But unfortunately, he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. During the assault on the television station in Moscow at Ostankino, tanks were surrounding the tower, and Rory was inside with other cameramen. And he stepped out to get a shot with his camera, and a tank was directly out the door. And the guy in the tank probably thought that this was, you know, a rocket launcher, and just blew poor Rory away. So, you know, it goes to show you're never safe in Moscow. But he's well remembered, and they've started a fund for him, for other freelance journalists to get insurance, because he basically left his wife and kids penniless. And so they had to raise money. Well, I wasn't going to go here yet, but 1994, I had kind of decided I'd had enough of being in Moscow. I'd seen it. It was turning into a place I didn't really like. It was wild, wild west. You know, ABC had started this policy that for people coming in to visit, you couldn't stay at a hotel where somebody had been shot in the lobby. And pretty soon, there was no place for people to stay because somebody had been shot in a hotel lobby somewhere in Moscow, in nearly every hotel in Moscow. So it was turning into, you know, I was feeling pretty unsafe. And one day, driving into work, two guys tried to run me off the road. I don't know if they were trying to carjack me or what, but I remember, and then they drove on because I think a police car came up, but I remember thinking at the time, you know, if I just had a gun in my glove compartment, this would be okay. And that's when I knew I had to get out of Moscow. So I said, you know, I gotta get out, this is just too much, I wanna go to London. They're like, yeah, hang in, there's nothing yet. And then Chechnya happened. And so I got sent to Chechnya, which I have to say, since I've covered a lot of wars, and this just felt like, I hate to say it, but the asshole of the universe, Chechnya did. It was just so awful and so scary and so isolated. I was kind of hoping to put a map on to kind of show you how we had to fly in, because we would have to fly into Mineralnye Vody, which is about 8 hours from Grozny. But you couldn't stay in Grozny because it looked like this. So we had to stay 2 hours outside in a place called Khasavyurt. And we stayed, all the news people stayed at an abandoned school. And we had the first floor of this abandoned school, and about 1,000 refugees had the second floor. So there were maybe 200 of us living downstairs, 1,000 of them upstairs. And, you know, we came in with crates of food and water and, you know, everything to live with, and they had nothing. And that was really hard to sort of reconcile. And we would have to drive every day, 2 hours into Grozny, to cover the story. And then the Russians started bombing. And it's one thing to cover a war. You know, if people are shooting at you, you know where not to be. But when stuff starts falling out of the sky, where do you go? It's you know, you take to the basements. But it was, I hated the uncertainty of it. And there was so I'd gone in, I'd done 3 weeks in Chechnya, I went back out, and I was coming in over Christmas to replace the other producer who was there. And we had to fly again into Mineralnaya Vody and got onto this van and I was with two other women, two other correspondents. And we were trying to sleep, we're driving through the night, just wasteland from, you know, as far as the eye could see. And all of a sudden I smell burning. I was like, uh-oh, this isn't good. So I made the drivers pull over and I made everybody else get out. And of course there was a fire in our van and we're stuck out in the middle of nowhere at 2 o'clock in the morning with all our stuff. And so standing by the side of the road, trying to flag down trucks, finally a bus comes along, flag them down. I said, you know, I'll give you $100 if you take us to Hasavyurt. Fine. So, you know, we pull our stuff on the bus, and it's a bus full of refugees who are trying to get, they're trying to get out, and we're taking them back in. And they're not happy about it, but the bus driver is like, you know, you can stay on the bus or you can get off. So they all stayed on the bus. And we were pulling into this school. We got into the town, and I was sitting next to the driver, and I was saying, you know, take a left here, take a right there, you know, go straight down here. And the guy I'm sitting next to turns and looks at me. He said, you've been here before? I said, yeah. He said, and you've come back? I was like, and that just kind of summed it up, I thought. So I managed to survive Chechnya. How, you know, it was hard. You know, got through the tough times with a lot of vodka. And, you know, the story I love to tell about being in Chechnya was, it was Christmas Eve. Everybody was really, really depressed that they were going to have to spend Christmas in such a place. And so I said to my driver, I said, here's $5. Can you go buy us some pot? And so he said, yeah, sure. So he comes back an hour later with, swear to God, a hefty bag full of marijuana. And so we were the happiest people in Chechnya over Christmas. And I left, you know, I don't really look back. It's, you know, I had an incredible time during those years. You know, I saw so much and did so much. Yeah, and I got to see history, and how many people can, you know, say that? And I think that's why we're all in the business. But anyway, that's my story.